This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3106 for Monday, the 29th of June 2020. Today's show is entitled Linux In-Laws Season 1 Episode 9 Postgres and is part of the series Linux In-Laws. It is hosted by Monochromec and is about 64 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is: the lads talk to Bruce Momji and Postgres Evangelist.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Linux In-Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. This is Linux In-Laws, Season 1, Episode 9. Postgres. As long-time listeners will know, Linux In-Laws is marked as explicit on most portals which rip off Hacker Public Radio, as episodes may contain graphic and strong language and may depict subjects including violence, drug abuse, nudity, such as the ultimate rule of free and open source software, addictive operating systems, and naked databases. This episode is no exception. As a matter of fact, listener's discretion is absolutely advised, as you may encounter shocking facts about databases in general, both SQL and NoSQL, Postgres in particular, and ancient history going back to 1986. Never mind bitching about MySQL. Faint-hearted listeners are advised to skip this episode. You have been warned. Due to technical challenges during the interview from an audio perspective, the sound quality of the recording may not be up to the high standards you can expect from Linux In-Laws. We would like to apologize for the circumstance and shift the blame squarely to Verizon and its rotten choice of crappy router hardware not playing nice with free and open source software like Big Blue Button. Good morning, Martin. How are things?
Good morning, Chris. I'm well. How are you?
Can't complain.
Another breakfast episode coming up.
Yeah, another day, another episode. But before we get to the most important interview guest, let's do some news. Something I came across recently. Apparently, Mint has decided to do away with snaps in terms of if you want to install Chrome, it tells you that, sorry, can't do this because this is only available as a snap from Ubuntu, which is the underlying distro. So if you want to install it, you have to do this manually, I'm afraid. What do you make of this?
It doesn't sound very user-friendly for a operating system that claims to be more user-friendly than Ubuntu.
Maybe we should get Richard Stallman on the case. What do you think?
It might be worth doing. I mean, do you actually know anybody who uses Mint, personally?
Yes, I do. You're talking to one of them.
Okay.
No. You see, I have a zoo. I have a zoo of virtual machines
Zoo, okay.
that I just use to show various people how great Linux is. And one of them, of course, runs Mint.
Of course. Okay.
Because the beauty about Mint is actually the installation is a breeze, because essentially you put an ISO on a stick, you put the stick into a computer, you boot this up. And then Mint does pretty much all the rest, including automatic partitioning and the whole shebang. So it also comes with quite a few non-free packages in terms of, for example, multimedia codecs, which normally are not bundled with the distro because you have to install this separately because of, for example, different licensing.
Yeah, when you say non-free, do we mean non-free and open source? What are we talking here?
Sometimes dual license, sometimes even closed source. It really depends on the implementation. So Mint is somewhat of a hybrid, let's put it this way. It's not a pure open source system, but maybe the Mint community maybe thinks differently about this.
Okay, do you know what the uptake is of Mint in terms
I
of
do not know.
usage?
There's a website called DistroWatch, right?
Yes, I
Let's
know.
see what the crack is. If I can find this.
It's just typically, other people go to Ubuntu, sorry, or go to a Linux. But, I haven't personally heard anybody saying, "Oh, I'm gonna run Mint from now
It's on position number 3, at
on."
least according to distrowatch.com. First two positions are MX Linux, never heard about this. And of course, and interestingly enough,
MX Linux.
Manjaro, which is an Arch spin.
Well, this is okay. What is this? PageHit ranking. Okay, there we
And
go.
yes, and position number 4 is Ubuntu, and then Debian. That's
Perhaps
amazing.
not the right metric, is it, to be using here?
Well, this is DistroWatch, right? Make what you
Well,
make of it what you want.
average number of hits per day. That's kind of okay.
Hits per day, yes.
It's
Whatever that means.
Well, it means that you can have as many bots running as you want to increase this number, basically.
That's probably how MX Linux, which I've never heard about, got to rank number 1. Interesting.
Yeah, I think this is also a practice that some other well, software manufacturers use, but
But I
let's
mean,
not go there.
yeah, but I mean, Manjaro is pretty cool. Have you ever used it?
No, I'm not a personal zookeeper like you are.
Fair enough, fair enough.
The pets there are of use to me.
No, Manjaro, it's quite interesting because it's essentially Arch, or it aims to be at people that like Arch but without the pain.
Right, got
So it comes with a graphic installer, comes with a pre I think even with a pre-installed desktop, something that a pure Arch user would have to do all manually, or use a meta package or something like this, based on their preferences. I mean, if you install Arch, there's a net install, and that gives you just a bare bone user land that doesn't even have a compiler, just enough to boot up the system, and then the real fun starts. In terms of configuring the network, configuring the desktop, and all the rest of it. And Manjaro takes the other approach in terms of, I'm almost tempted to say it's similar to what Mint is for Ubuntu is Manjaro for Arch, but I wouldn't go that far. Because as far as I know, Manjaro doesn't, for example, include kind of multimedia codecs right away. But then I've never, I think I only installed it once just for a couple of hours just to play with it. But then, of course, being the arch purist that I am, I said, no, this is not for me. So, but quite a few people use it, and the project is quite active. Talk to a
Okay.
num talk to a number of the, of the community talk to a number of the members of the community at various open source events when they were still around, as in physical ones, not this virtual nonsense crap.
Well, you can still talk to them even on a virtual one,
Yes, but what's the point? Okay.
Well, conversation.
Yes, but
What do you mean, yes, but?
that's all.
Sorry.
I mean, the social aspect is totally missing there.
You mean the
So,
beer?
No, the social aspect, as in the body language, the facial stuff, and all the rest of it, that makes human interaction so very important. I mean,
Just for our listeners, Chris is quite an animated speaker.
thank you,
So
Mr. Thank you, Mr.
make sure you stand well back on the conversation.
I see. Anything else that our listeners should know about me, Martin? While you're at it.
All will be revealed in due course.
I see. Okay, enough ranting about Mint and well, actually, and of course, the implication is that this restricts a certain level of freedom when it comes to software. Needless to say, links will be in the show notes, so feel free to check this out yourself and make up your own mind. Essentially, needless to say, if you have opinions about this, there's this magical email address called feedback@linuxinlaws.eu.
Yeah, and likewise, if you are a Mint user, please do also do get in touch. We
Indeed, indeed,
speak to
indeed.
someone in the world.
Exactly. And if you want to do a full episode of Manjaro or Mint, for that matter, we do welcome guests.
Excellent.
So, is there anything else we should talk about before we should get on our guest? Speaking of which.
Yeah, no, I was just going to mention a piece of news that struck me this week, which it ties into our open source technology as well, and also slightly related to our guest in terms of he's been a long-standing open source project member, coordinator, contributor, but yeah, so open source can be used quite badly as well, right? It doesn't give you any guarantees to make a secure system, as we know. And there was yet another breach in the UK, this time on the health system, which is happily sharing recordings of private consultations with amongst their users. So being able to see other people's video recordings of their health consultations with their doctors. So, and the fact is, it's just, I know this company a little bit from work-related activities, and they're called Babylon Health. But so do look them up,
Okay.
and don't sign up to their service unless you want your your doctor's appointments remotely shared through other users.
And that company was breached, or?
No, it's basically, it sounds like well, more of a
a
let's put it.
A cluster
Yes,
factory.
that is the technical term.
To use the technical term now, yes.
Yes.
Interesting name. That reminds me a little bit of something called Babylon 5, which I think was a TV series way back.
Yes, I remember this.
But they apparently they didn't encounter breaches, at least on the episodes that I watched, which weren't many, to be honest. So
Well,
how,
we could rant about DevOps and all the agile development that happens these days, but
Yeah,
it comes at certain cost, right?
but we won't, so that's okay. Just out of curiosity, how was this leak published?
It's on the BBC.
The British Broadcasting Corporation. Okay, so it must be true.
Well, I won't go
It took it,
that
Martin, this took a second too long.
far. Sorry.
For those of you who don't know the BBC is a monopoly, I think it's called, in Great Britain, basically covering news and other items. Certain, what's the word I'm looking for? Governments have used it as their disposal, to with varying levels of success, I might add.
And also well, state funded, yeah.
Yes, it's
Everybody
state,
in the UK has to have
exactly.
a TV license,
It's
which,
state funded. Some people like this, some people do not. For example, there's a certain Mr. Johnson, I think, apparently at the moment, who is somewhat opposed to the idea of continuing the BBC service as such. And never mind, given the fact that the BBC is a bit of a tradition in the UK.
No, it's
But
yeah. I mean, you can say the same about the NHS and the National Rail and all these kind of things, right? Where do you go with privatisation or not with all these companies? So, there is something to be said for state funding of certain functions, but then it also, as you can see, become a monopoly, right? So, in that respect, and.
So do you think that actually Margaret Thatcher diversion from communism, because that was the prevailing government form, government type, right? Before Maggie took that wrong turn, was a turn in the right direction or not for the country in general?
The idea is great, but in practice it was very. It wasn't a very bad idea, right? Let's put it that way.
Privatization. Okay.
Yes.
I see. Yeah. But I mean,
yeah. I mean, the idea is obviously, you know, if you have privatization, then you have competition, and you get the best service again, blah blah blah, and the best price. But you know, with a real service, that doesn't really work all that well.
funny enough, if you bring up the rail service, yes. I can. But by the way, I can recall standing in front of signs about a year ago in Great Britain, promising me to get my money back if the train is 15 minutes late.
It's an hour, isn't it?
I thought it was 15 minutes.
No. It's an hour.
Okay.
15 minutes. You get all your money back all the time. You may as well not run at all.
Yeah, but then I can also recall being stuck in some train station in the middle of nowhere, and that was quite late, and all the trains that were supposed to go for the remainder of the day, which was I think an hour or something, showed cancelled. That wasn't impressive because I had to make my way back using alternative means of transport, which turned out to be quite expensive. But that's another story probably. Okay. So let's bring on our guest. This time, you want to introduce them?
Yeah, so them?
Him, sorry.
Oh, sorry. I was about to say, is there someone that I missed?
No, him. You want to introduce him?
Yes, so I'll introduce him. So this week's guest is esteemed Postgres project coordinator Bruce Momjan, doing this for the PostgreSQL database for... over 25 years, I think. I worked with Bruce a fair bit, and he's a great speaker, very passionate about open source. And,
excellent. Tonight we have a special guest by the name of Bruce Momjan, community coordinator. Of course, I get this wrong, but Bruce, why don't you introduce yourself?
So I'm Bruce Momjan. I live in Philadelphia. I've been working with Postgres for 24 years. I've been working in open source probably 5 or 6 years more than that. I enjoy what I do. I work for EnterpriseDB. I used to travel a lot, but not so much now. But I do a lot of conferences. Now I'm doing conferences online. I'm one of the Postgres core team members responsible for sort of, you know, just managing the project and the team and encouraging new developers. And it's a lot of fun.
So
okay,
for those,
that's great. Sorry, I was just going to tag on to that, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead, Martin, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, I mean, with your long and standing open source experience, is there one tip you would like to give any budding open source developers out there?
one of the fundamental things that I remember telling people, and, you know, I haven't said it in so long because it actually must have sunk in, that as open source developers, we are not creating software to create software. Okay? Yeah. We are creating software for people to use. And what I had a problem with in the early years were people in the Postgres project were so focused on solving problems and on creating elegant solutions, they didn't have a vision or a focus on the user experience and the user benefit that was part of what they were doing. So I would basically say, you know, we could just sit around and write software ourselves for ourselves forever, right? Yep. But this project is much more than that. This project is about providing a service and a utility to the IT professionals around the world that gives them new capabilities and new vision and new open source capabilities that did not exist before. So that was probably my biggest thing, was getting out of the sort of, we're writing it for hobbyists, we're writing it for ourselves, and that's okay, but we have to also realize that we always have to have a connection to our community. We always have to understand, what are we doing that's, what if we're working on project, on feature X, how is that going to benefit our community, right? Because a lot of times as engineers, we're so focused on our own needs and our own, let's solve this problem, let's fix this problem, let's figure out how to make this work, that we lose the focus.
That's a big part of your role, right, as a coordinator for this project, to be that voice.
Yeah, sorry, Bruce, yeah. Before we go any further, maybe there are still about 5 to 10 people on this planet who do not know what Postgres is. Maybe you could, for the benefit of these few people, just shortly give an overview of what this project is all about.
Yeah, you know, in fact, there's a lot more to it than you would guess. So Postgres started in 1986 in the University of California, Berkeley, by Michael Stonebreaker, as being the next generation of relational system. That's why it's Postgres or Post-Ingres at that point. And for the first 10 years, it was really a research project funded by the U.S. Department of Defense, similar to the way Unix was, BSD Unix was supported by the Department of Defense. In 1996, Postgres had really left the university. It had been no longer being developed, full-time. And I and a group of other people sort of took over the code from the few people at Berkeley who were still working on it and brought it to internet development. And we've been doing that for the past 24 years. The early years were obviously a lot of bug fixing, adding enterprise features and so forth. But what you have now is a real world-class database that probably does more than Oracle does from a developer's perspective, probably does a little less than Oracle does from an administrative perspective, but is really a first-class alternative to the proprietary databases, just as Linux took over the HPUXs and Solarises and AIXs of the world 10 years ago. And, you know, they're proprietary companies, some of them, like Fujitsu or NTT. And, you know, we're like, that's okay because we're not dependent on you if you go away, like somebody else.
They contribute to the open source code as well.
Oh, yeah, they contribute a lot. And you kind of, it's the same thing. Like, you use the proprietary stuff to forward your agenda, but when things turn badly, you have to have a clear exit strategy. And that's why we host our own website. We host our own email infrastructure. We don't really rely on anything external because we're scared of that. But that's infrastructure. So it's hard to change. Something like a podcast, you know, if you switch from Zoom to Google to Zoom, you know, Skype, it's not really going to affect, as long as your hosting platform is stable, right? So that's another problem. So you can move around between different ones as long as they're all.
I think we definitely need an alternative for these. Yeah, that's for sure. But I mean, from the project side, this is it's unlikely that Postgres is ever going to be taken over like a one of those other open source projects at any one company, right? This is the way it's been organized, and
we've always been really paranoid about that. I think because, you know, the MySQL situation was just so terrible. I mean, you knew they were just riding that open source distribution channel with no open source community, with very little open source development, you know, and you knew they were just kind of riding that, similar, I guess, to the way BitLocker did. They just rode open sources until the big payday. And you see that over and over again in so many open source projects. That when we sort of set Postgres up, we're like, okay, people are really in this for the technology. They're not really in it for the paycheck. There isn't any real one single commercial entity that controls it. The core team can't have more than a majority, can't have a majority of people from any one company. And, you know, I could reel off 10 different companies in all geos that support Postgres. I remember one case, the early company, Great Bridge, we've always been aware that there are certain companies like MySQL who who were really using open source as a vehicle to distribute their software. Okay, so it's kind of like sort of me putting on a jacket that says I'm on it with a certain team and just running out onto the field. I'm not a football player, but I look like one maybe, right? So there have been a lot of companies that did that, BitLocker being one of them, MySQL. There's a ton of them active now. Mongo, another big one, who's really out there to say, hey, we're open source, and there's no lock-in or whatever that means, and you should use us. But underlying that, all of the product decisions, all the development, all the licensing, is really run by a single company, and Postgres has known that that's been around for a long time. Hmm. And it's sort of structured ourselves in a way that the companies know that they need us, we don't need them. If the companies go away, Postgres will be fine. If Postgres goes away, those companies are dead, right? I mean, and that's all of the companies really understand that dependence. And anyone doesn't understand it, they kind of don't last very long. So it's nice. They can take the software if they want and just go and do whatever they want to do with it. Green Plum did that for many years. Now they're trying to come back in the community. There's another one. You've got Aurora now, which is a fork of Postgres, and Enterprise DB has a fork. So there's a lot of companies kind of.
You're not telling me that Amazon have come back to share this code with you.
No, well, Amazon did. They did that. What was that called? They had a database based on Postgres 8 or 8.1. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but anyway, and that one sort of is still around. And then they took Postgres, they put in RDS, which it didn't modify Postgres very much, and then they have an Aurora product that also uses the Postgres code. So if some company wants to just go and run with the code, they're able to do that. If some company wants to work with the community and do sort of co-development, which is the majority of companies, obviously, were there to do that. But the way the core team structured, the way the community structured, they're not the focus. They don't control the sales channels. They don't control the product, the features, what gets into the code. That's all really determined by this whole group of community people.
Yeah, great. I mean, we've done this Postgres for such a long time, right? And I don't think we touched on how you got involved with the projects to start with. But is it something that you think you'll be doing for a while longer, or have you looked at any other? Are there any other open source projects out there that interest you, or are of the same maturity, do you think?
Yeah, I realize it's almost a blessed sort of choice years ago, but. I've always been interested in SQL databases, really from, 1989 when I started using them. I always found them interesting, and I tried writing my own SQL database a couple times before Postgres. But I realized as I started coding it that the project was just way, way too complicated for me. But the cool thing about the database for me is, I don't know. I just find it interesting. I'm not sure there's another place I would go. Fortunately, there's a whole bunch of cases. 24 years. There's a whole bunch of places I could have gotten off. Right? This is not going where I want it to go. Or I find this other thing I'm interested in. But fortunately, I stuck with it just because I kind of still find it interesting. We've always tried to have a community that. That is a place you want to be, not a hostile place, but a place that is sort of affirming and welcoming and a friendly place. So I think that's a lot of our value is, if I look at a conference from 2006, which was our first conference in Toronto, 80-90% of those people are still with us. It's 13 years, they're still with us. Because I think Postgres does provide a platform and an environment that's pretty rare in development in general, where you have these really complicated problems. You have good funding, you have good need for the software within a lot of industries, and at the same time, it's a place to belong. It's a place to provide value to the world. It's a place to solve interesting problems, deal with interesting challenges, grow as a developer. And I think all those kind of combined together to make it kind of a great place to be. And I think that's how we've been able to retain so many people. And because the software is so complicated, we really need to retain them, because it takes a couple years before you're even really up to the point where you can add a major feature to the database.
Taking a little step back here, Bruce, when I did a little bit of research about Postgres, which, by the way, runs on the majority of my, at least, ARM cores doing various things, I noticed that you were heading for your own license called Postgres License. Maybe you can share a little bit about the decision behind this and why you didn't go for a more common license in terms of MIT, BSD3 clause, maybe even GNU, and maybe you can also elaborate on the context of this in an open source initiative perspective.
Sure. So we were BSD. When we started the project in 96, we thought we were BSD licensed, right? I mean, came from Berkeley. It looked like the BSD license in terms of its content, right, and what it covered. So we, for years, decades, I think, we would just say we're BSD licensed. A website would say that. Anyone who would ask us, we would say it. And that meant a whole bunch of things, such as you can create proprietary products with it. There's no sort of copyleft requirement. You can do whatever you want with it. It'll always be available. What became clear about 10 years ago was that we are not BSD licensed. That although the content is virtually the same as the BSD Unix license, which of course came out of the same university, the same funding structure, the wording is slightly different. And we don't feel we have the right to change that, because the license had been done back in 86. One of the reasons Postgres is so unusual is that everyone who's active now really didn't get involved till 96 or later. So we sort of were given this complete database in a way. So nobody really wrote it from scratch, at least that's currently active. We're kind of looking back at the 10 years before we started, and we're saying, well, that's what they did. We can't change that. So what we ended up doing was basically going to the open source OSI and getting our license approved as valid. Now, did we have to do it? I don't know. I mean, it looked like a BSD license, but lawyers basically said, yeah, you kind of have to do it because there's this one or two words that are slightly different. So we effectively, we are BSD licensed or MIT licensed, but there is this wording difference that requires us to have a separate license. I guess we could have made a whole big thing and said, we're just going to change the wording on the license, but we still would have had to carry the old wording. It's kind of weird.
And you never considered kind of to really enforce the open source spirit to go for a more, confined license like the GPL or something?
No, there's a couple reasons for that, but what the GPL has really, to us, the GPL is a pessimistic license. It assumes that the software will be overtaken by some other entity, right? And that other entity will effectively close off the code and do all the development and then sort of starve the open source project. Now, I'm sure there are open source projects that has happened to. But from the Postgres case, we look at it as we sort of, I would say, approach the project, the licensing in a confident way, saying if you want to take the code and create a fork of Postgres, which dozens of companies have done, go ahead. You're not harming us. Our community is strong enough to take that. And we don't feel that that's really working against us. On the positive side, there's a lot of companies that have created proprietary versions of Postgres, including my own employer, Enterprise DB, okay? But they still support open source Postgres, and a good portion of their business is open source Postgres, right? I think if we had had a BSD GPL style license, they would have been too scared off to get involved with Postgres. So in a way, it's sort of like if you're dating somebody and you say, listen, before we go out, you got to do ABC. Well, the person's not going to go out with you, right? Because you're giving them all these preconditions. With Postgres, we kind of come and say, here's the license, do whatever you want. If you want to work at the community, great. If you don't want to, that's fine. Greenplum's a great example. Took the code, developed a closed door version for a long period of time, and then probably 5 years ago came back and said, you know, Postgres has moved so far forward that our code based on an older version of Postgres is really not as viable. We want to get our code up to the version of Postgres that's currently being shipped, and we want to effectively open source our project. So that's a great example where a single company really couldn't keep up with Postgres and decided, you know, we're better off working with the community than trying to fork and run. And Enterprise DB does the same thing. They work with the community. They don't fork and run, you know, the way from it.
So, Mr. Stallman, if you're listening, that's another deviation from the true spirit of communism. Some people may consider this to be hampering innovation, but then I can see both sides of the coin. Martin, over to you.
Yeah, so obviously we have to mention the rise of NoSQL, and you already mentioned MongoDB earlier, but having grown up with SQL database myself, I can see both sides of the coin. But is Postgres looking to do more in that area? I mean, there are obviously some extra cases that you already can, you know, you can do your JSON and things like that. But are we still thinking as a project being that all-encompassing database and not, whereas those niche specialized NoSQL databases are very much a one-sided show. So how do you see that going forwards for Postgres? Because I mean, obviously there is a lot of uptake of the likes of the MongoDBs, etc., of these worlds, right?
Yeah. So again, it's a question of how you look at your competitive landscape, right? Do you see them as opportunities or threats, right? Or are they showing new workloads that you can subsume, or are they something that you have to sort of fight against? One of the interesting things about the reason Postgres was developed in 1986 was because they, even at that time, when you were talking, how many years ago, 30-some years ago, we're talking about a case where even then it was clear that the relational model, as good as it was not able to handle every workload, right? Mm-hmm. Couldn't handle things like GIS or geometry points. Couldn't handle, obviously, things like full-text searches we've had, and GIS and JSON and a whole bunch of other stuff. I even have a talk on my website that talks about non-relational Postgres. But the point is that we're continuing, because Postgres was designed as extendable back in 86, it makes it very easy for us to effectively improve Postgres in a way that doesn't have to sort of rip out the relational part. You're able to sort of move in new index types, new data types, new languages, and so forth, without having to sort of throw away the relational parts of the system. At the time when I started in 96, that whole extendable object relational part was a huge headache for us. Seemed like a waste of time, made the system much more complicated. But now in 2000, when we're looking at the system, that extendability has allowed us to effectively subsume so many workloads that in a lot of cases we do the NoSQL workloads better than the NoSQL systems do. Even with the transaction handling, even with the durability and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of amazing that you're taking a system that wasn't designed for a lot of the things it does today, but was designed as more of a data platform. And I think as people, as we start to digitize things we never digitized before, right? You know, your phone has so much need for data storage, right? You know, there's so much analytics going on, Internet of Things analytics, data analytics that people never did before. What's great is that Postgres is able to sort of morph itself, not break itself, but morph itself into these new workloads in a really seamless way that you would think was impossible for a relational system that was written so many years ago. But that's the cool thing, and I think that's just going to continue. If you're, you know, if you're just the database that handles workloads from the 1990s, not going to be. Yeah, that's just not the place to be.
Well, you've seen the rise of the various different models like time series and graph over the time. Are people actively working on extensions for that in Postgres as well?
Yeah, we do have in Postgres 11 and 12, we added something called a storage manager. So as you know, we have, you know, key value store, we have JSON, full text search, stuff like that, document store.
Yep.
But there are now people working on different storage systems for columnar, which is something you can't do as efficiently in Postgres than you can in a natural columnar database. I know somebody's probably working on a graph database option. I know there are people who are working on AI, machine learning stuff. There's a whole bunch of work going on that's actually been completed a couple of years ago to allow Postgres to operate as a full data warehouse. So you don't have to dump your relational data out into another system.
Some of that work from Greenplum going back into Postgres?
Actually, I don't think we've had anything. I can't even remember a patch from Greenplum. It's mostly around Brin indexing and Brin indexing. Window functions came out of Japan. Brin index came out of Second Quadrant of Chile. We had Cube and Rollup that came out of England. Common table expressions that also came out of Japan. So it's just a lot of what's really amazing about Postgres is because we have a distributed team, we're able to work in like five or six directions at the same time. When you look at a Postgres release that we major release every year, these releases have like improvements in usability, improvements in scaling, improvements in performance, data warehousing, you know, application stuff, tooling improvements, backup improvements, so administrative. So that's the great stuff is you have different groups working on a whole bunch of different security, working on different stuff independently, and they all kind of come together to apply their patches to a common code base. So instead of having to manage these teams and sort of get them all to march in one direction, they all march in whatever direction they want. They have to do it in a way the community approves. But it does allow you to kind of do five things at once. It's almost impossible for companies to do that, but open source seems to be able to do it pretty well.
Which is the very nature of open source, Bruce, I reckon. Going back to the NoSQL discussion, I can recall a project called ToroDB, which actually bridged that gap in the document database space. Given the fact that this project, at least with regards to the GitHub commit, seems to be pretty dormant. Do you know what the true story behind this is?
Oh, sure, yeah. I know Alvaro Hernandez for many years.
You do? Okay.
Yeah, he's out of Madrid. In fact, he's been to the house a couple of times, and he had a great conference in Ibiza last year, so really great guy. He's more of a Java person and obviously had seen a need to create this Java layer on top of Postgres that allowed Postgres to speak the Mongo protocol and then sort of split apart the Mongo document into pieces which were then stored in Postgres. But you know, the problem you have with any kind of fork of Postgres or sort of offshoot that isn't sort of in the main tree is you've really got to have a lot of momentum behind it because Postgres is moving so quickly and sort of closing up a bunch of problems or it's expanding so quickly that you have to like have this sort of really amazing solution to kind of distinguish yourself in that market. And I'm guessing that it worked really well. I mean, I know him. I'm sure it was really well engineered. But here's the thing. People I'm even giving a talk about this in a couple of weeks, but one of the crazy things that's happened over the years is when Postgres started, it was a nothing, right? It was like, what's Postgres, right? And if it's something data I don't care about, or I have no money, okay, maybe I'll use it. But if it's data I care about or I have money, I'm not going to use it, right? What you have in 2000 now are people saying, I now have more confidence in Postgres than I do in Oracle or Microsoft. In terms of longevity, in terms of ability to solve the problem, in terms of fitness for purpose, right? And that's a different environment.
It's quality of code as well, right?
Because right, quality of code, those, right? Reliability across the board, right? Yeah. So the issue now is you're sort of like, okay, now people are saying, instead of Postgres being below the typical proprietary relational database, in a lot of ways it's above it, right? So for somebody else to come in with another project, even Greenplum, which is backed by Pivotal, it's a huge thing, but at the same time, people are like, yeah, I like Greenplum, but this Postgres thing is more than a data warehouse, right? And maybe I'd like that better. People don't want a whole bunch of different databases in their data center. And I don't blame them, because you gotta manage it, you gotta back it up, you gotta make sure it's reliable. Whole bunch of administrative problems that are challenges, tasks you have when you bring in a new database. So I think the problem with TorDB was not that it wasn't good, but it had to solve a big enough problem to get in the door against a community Postgres that already had a very high reputation. Right? And that's the problem. How do you do that? Sometimes you can do it with an extension. So you can create an extension to Postgres. That's what Citus did, which was purchased by Microsoft 2 years ago or so. So Citus was an extension that did data warehousing, and it was a little easier, I think, for them to get adoption, because you were still using Postgres. You were using Postgres plus this extension. I think with Tor, I think maybe it was like a layer on top. So you had a layer on top of Postgres. But it's just very hard. Postgres is now so big that it's really hard to get visibility in that market. I mean, let's look at it. For example, how many other relational open source databases are there today? Like, there's Maria and MySQL, which are kind of it. There used to be Firebird. There used to be Interbase, which was being Firebird. There used to be a whole bunch of other ones, but what's happened over the years is Postgres has become so big that anybody who's doing open source relational database development pretty much is Postgres. Like, that's pretty much it, right? So yeah. As you get bigger and bigger, the problem is you cast a bigger shadow, and it's harder for other projects to get mindshare and to get, sort of interest from customers. And I think that's the biggest problem, because people just don't want another database, another solution, unless it solves a really critical problem. And I guess maybe not enough people had the problem it solved. I'm not a Java guy. I don't know Mongo very well, so I'm not the guy to guess that. But I know that that is the typical challenge that anyone has when you're looking at Postgres, that it's so big and so well known and has such a reputation. Anything added to that is going to have a challenge.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, I know, obviously, I'm a great fan of Postgres, but it's moving fast.
Just wondering.
No, it's probably coming
legacy,
from
right?
coming from a proprietary Oracle background, and the first time being introduced to Postgres, I was like, wow, this stuff can do everything, and it does it really well. Okay, anyway, but I think one thing that kind of what I've seen maybe lagging behind a bit is the sharding story. Has that been developed a little bit more?
Oh, that is so true. I mean, that's one of those, as I said before, that's one of those where I'm going to get up and just like, listen, we're not doing what we should do. So the sharding story is really interesting. It's the kind of, so the narrative behind the sharding story, and this is a weird example, is that when somebody is choosing a database, they want to know that it will scale to multiple machines. Mm-hmm. That's just like a checkbox now, right? So even if you're a small company, you're going to be the next Google, right? Or the next Zoom, or the next whatever, right? Yeah. So I don't care what database I choose. I got to choose something that can scale to multiple servers. And even though, you know, a lot of large companies are running Postgres without that sharding and running it very well for global workloads, you know, credit card companies running Postgres, right? You can imagine how much transactions they do on single machines. Big machines, but single machines. What happens is that it's sort of this checkbox that's required. The problem, though, is that once people realize what Postgres can do on a single machine, they realize that running it on multiple machines is kind of like a headache. Like, if I can run it on a single machine, why would I want to shard my data, make it harder to manage, make it harder to back up? Like, I don't need to do that. Databases naturally want to do vertical scaling. Horizontal scaling can work. NoSQL, you know, probably, you know, really staked out its whole reason for being on the horizontal scaling base. But when you look at what most people use NoSQL for, even though that's really what it was designed, most people are running it on a single server, right? They want the option of running on multiple servers, but a lot of times if they're running two or three servers, it's just for redundancy. It's not for load balancing, right? So the point is there's this disconnect between what people want in sharding potentially and what people actually are going to put in production. So as much as I like sharding and continue to push it, I have not been able to get enough community interest around it to get all the pieces I think are necessary to get it done. I've been working on it for 3 years. I've got presentation on a website. It's a connection. It's a combination of partitioning, which we have now. Mm-hmm. It's a combination of foreign data wrappers with pushdown, which we have now. It's a combination of parallelism, which we have now. But there are some missing parallelism pieces. There are some missing transaction management pieces. There's some missing snapshot distribution pieces that we need to basically get a full production, either as a data warehouse or as an OLTP cluster solution. So the good news is somebody emailed me this week. They want to create HiGo out of China, wants to create sort of a working group around this to sort of push sharding forward. I think we have 5 or 10 companies now interested in this. So we're going to have meetings. Right. We haven't had a meeting yet, but just this week, it looks like we now have more push on this. I think it's almost there. I don't think there's that much more work to do. We have companies in China, Japan, Russia, United States, all interested in this. So I'm hopeful we can get an answer, but it's the disconnect between what people want initially and what they actually need today that I think has slowed down that project.
Right. No, that's an interesting perspective because it's, I mean, it's one of the biggest, as you know, selling points of NoSQL, right? But
did you want to go back to what I said before? Yeah. One of the great things about sharding is it can be done in a holistic manner. It doesn't have to be a bolted on, let's add 150,000 lines of code to make it happen. You're basically just improving foreign data wrappers. You're improving pair transactions. You're improving the partitioning code. And all of a sudden you get sharding by just expanding out in little places. And I think that's another example of how Postgres sort of grows organically to handle these new workloads.
Okay, Bruce, I think we have to wrap this up in the interest of time. There's a certain thing that we do with all our guests called POX. It's the pick of the week in terms of something that you've come across recently, as it doesn't have to be the week, but rather that something that interests you, something that you care to remember. And of course, there's also anti-POX, which probably resorts to Oracle, MySQL, SQL Server, something like this. I'm just guessing. Sorry, take your pick.
So you're interested in something interesting I've seen recently?
Yeah, something that struck your something that's interesting to you, right, in the news.
Yeah, I think the big thing for me is trying to understand. I've worked remotely since 94 or so, but trying to understand what the new world is going to look like going forward in terms of travel, in terms of online conferences, online meetings, how much of our world going forward is going to be more virtual, more sort of electronic. One of the interesting things is I'm now talking to people on the other side of the country much more regularly now than I did, you know, before.
Yeah.
Because now somebody's doing a church event in California and I'm attending it, you know, because we're all on Zoom and we're doing that. Tonight I have an event with somebody in New York who's doing a Bible study right out of New York. And normally I would never have gone to New York for that, but now it's online. So just as open source, I think, has brought together so many people from so many different countries, this, you know, this sort of quarantine thing is sort of allowing us to connect virtually to people who are pretty far away. So we're creating our own virtual communities in a way that we hadn't before. It'd be interesting how much of that sticks around and how much of it goes back to the way we did things before. That's kind of where I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Is interesting.
Well, I mean, you like to travel, right? So which one do you prefer?
I do. You know, the weirdest thing for me is I'm now in the same bed every night, it took me about 6 weeks to kind of hit me as I'm in bed. I'm thinking, I've been here every night for like weeks. And because I'm always, you know, home long enough and, you know, for a couple of weeks, but, you know, the clock's always ticking to the next trip, and now it's not. So I'm able to do a lot more research. I'm able to work on a lot more bigger projects. And of course I'm not spending a lot of time kind of flying all over the place. I miss it. I did have a very busy travel schedule at the end of 2019 and 2020. So, I was definitely ready for a break and I'm enjoying it. But I do think things are going to, you know, start warming up in the next couple months.
Yeah, I think so. And do you have anything on the reverse side that you completely struck you for a negative reason, apart from the obvious?
I'm a pretty positive guy. I don't think I saw anything. I don't think I've seen a whole lot of negative. No.
All right. No, that does it well. That's fine. So, yeah, I mean, as Chris said, we've got to kind of wrap this up. Thank you very, very much. It's, you know, I'm a great Perspress fan, and I'm sure Chris will be as well after this, after the interview. So once again, thank you for this. Keep up the good work with Postgres, I would say. It's,
thank you so much.
All right, thank you again, and speak to you again soon.
Sure.
Take care.
Martin, that was an excellent interview. Although
it was a great interview.
Yeah, perfect, yeah. Although, yes, he's a bit of a talker, isn't he? Which I like, by the way, don't get me wrong.
Yes, he's passionate, right? And after spending that many years on an open source project, still having that drive, it's great.
Okay, so all that remains to be done is, of course, the lovely feedback that we got.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, yes, Luna Jernberg, or should I say Martin Jernberg? Not too sure, they're sharing the same email address, so I'm not too sure what of the two names is an alias or not. So okay. Luna/Martin wrote in to say that... let me read this out. Hello, listen to the latest episode now. Missed they were released, but saw it when scrolling by the HBR feed over the weekend. Yes, Luna/Martin, thank you very much for the feedback. You're bringing up a very important point. We are hosted on Hacker Public Radio. So wherever you get your podcast from, we now have our own RSS feed on Hacker Public Radio. We will continue to use Hacker Public Radio for the time being. And if we should decide to move elsewhere, you'll be the first to know in terms of hearing it here first. And then Luna wrote a second mail saying that the Catalina thing was fixed later in May. And of course, that was a reference to Audacity 2.4.1. And of course, the workaround that Catalina and its security measures, as in the latest installment of the OS X operating system, has a certain limitation when it comes down to apps accessing the hardware, the camera, and the microphone. And there's a workaround that we kind of discussed. And apparently the Audacity team fixed this in 2.4.1. Haven't checked this out on Mac, so we'll do this shortly. And of course, Luna/Martin is absolutely right. Audacity is 20 years now. because this is basically what she or he wrote, that now 2 decades have gone by with this lovely tool that, of course, we also use for producing this podcast, has been in existence. Any closing remarks, Martin, before we close off the episode?
The Claudia response to the response to the response is a great episode, so do listen, listeners.
If you're so inclined, Claudia, yes, and we are looking for a review of the review of the review. If you want to do one, doesn't have to be a full episode on HPR. You can write to us. The email address is feedback@Martin.
Linux. Shall we do in-laws today?
Inlaws.eu. Yes, excellent. And of course, our website is also www.linuxinlaws.eu. No dash, just one word. And looking forward to having you with the next episode.
Yes,
Martin, take care.
Thank you.
This episode of Linux In-Laws is proudly sponsored by Oracle. Disappointed with too fast database access when all you really need is a slow backend allowing the user to have more time to ponder about buying decisions for your e-commerce site? Becoming more and more tired with getting the same precise result sets, never mind how ambiguous the query really is? Fret not. Oracle has you covered. Introducing Real Oracle, the first database with such low performance your customers will love the time they will have pondering your beautiful e-commerce site while waiting for the shopping cart confirmation. Never mind the huge set of articles ranging from tulips to potatoes to sex toys to choose from when all they are searching for is a simple bulb. Real Oracle by Oracle. You know you want it. This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
Okay, that's painful again. I don't know what this big blue marble is, but if I see it one more time, I'm going to avoid it and run the other direction.
Oh.
I think we lost him.
I think, yeah. It's probably because he's on his phone.
Oh, dear.
It's a shame, isn't it? He was going reasonably. Yeah.
Nice introduction to the project. Let's keep on rolling and let's talk about the
Yeah, that's Oh, man. That's interesting, isn't it?
Oh, fuck it. Verizon, if you're listening, this is crap.
I find it a little bit weird that not many more people have this issue, right? But anyway, let's not go there now.
He's coming back now.
Yep.
And no, Verizon, I won't edit this out.
Point.
If you're listening, T-Mobile does a way better job than you are. Never mind whether I used to work for you or not. Of course, we do still accept sponsorships, but that's probably another issue. No, Verizon, but you can't buy your way into this. No worries. Anyway, Bruce isn't joining now.
Yes.
Maybe we can put this into the outtakes or something. Anyway,
Yes.
He's still struggling, isn't he? Yeah, too bad. Okay.
Yeah,
Martin is recording.
Recording.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, so we were bitching about Big Blue Button and then some database later on.
Yeah, I don't know where I actually cut out or what I was saying.
You were talking about the MySQL go-to-market and the marketing front that Oracle used subsequently, if I understood you correctly. But then audio broke up later on, so maybe you care to repeat slash elaborate?
Sure, yeah, so...
Okay, that was an excellent interview, I think.
Yeah.
But he's a bit of a talker, isn't he?
Oh, I thought you said cut.
We can still edit this out.
Stop recording. What are we doing?
No,
are we still recording?
No. Yes, we are.
Okay, yes, I'm still recording. You said cut, so I was just about to...
Yeah, cut is actually after... Oh, jeez, this has to be edited. Oh, okay, fair enough. No, we are after the interview, Martin. Okay,
I know we're after the interview.
And yes. Let's roll again.
It was a couple of days ago.
Yes. Cut and roll.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.